Who are you?
Tim Callender.
Summer Brooks.
Brett Filipek.
We host the Babylon podcast.
What do you want?
To study and discuss the Babylon 5 universe.
Where are you going?
To discover every scrap of B5 memorabilia.
Who do you serve, and who do you trust?
And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I'm Summer Brooks, and I just got tangled up in my own headphone wire here. How the hell did that?
I'm Tim Callender, and I'm just sitting here.
And Brett's off doing daddy things, so we'll let him slide.
Oh, good for him being a daddy. That's a wonderful job to have, actually.
I honestly don't know how I got tangled up in this wire.
I do.
Oh, I see.
Alcohol.
No, actually, I have not had any beer today.
Okay, no alcohol.
I was...
You're too leaving. Sober.
No, the mic is... I have a boom stand for the mic. This is my boom stick! And... and I was ducking under it to type out tweets and IRC stuff, and somehow it got wrapped around me. Okay. That's all right.
All right, then.
See, I like to share our recording acrobatics with our listeners because they're funny and because I was trying to get untangled. There we go.
There you go. Mike, I believe we have a special guest tonight. Although I say guest, he gave us a pre-recorded message. Anyways, contacted Jeffrey. Jeffrey has recorded his thoughts and remembrances on the passing of Jeff Conway. And he recorded a video for that. So if you're on the Ustream video watching this, you'll get to see Jeffrey in all his glory. But you'll also get the beautiful dulcet tones of Jeffrey's comments. But I'm not trying to cheapen this. I talked with Jeffrey earlier, and I think we will all be moved by what Jeffrey has to say about Jeff Conway. So, Mike, can you roll that, please?
Callender, the brainwaves you have spent analyzing Babylon 5 have caused your hair to vaporize. So the next time you're thinking about doing a podcast, do something on porn. Understanding is a three-edged sword. Understanding. Where did I put all those pebbles? I don't know. Wait. Tim Callender? Is that you, Tim Callender? You're still doing the Babylon podcast? The show has been off for years. Babylon 5 is beyond the rim. You've already spoken more words than JMS ever even thought about Babylon 5. Tim, you must move on. Get out of the basement. Get a life. Make more of life. Life is short. Too short. Yeah, that's why I'm here. Hi, it's Jeffrey. Tim, thank you very much for asking me to come on and say a few things about our friend Jeff Conway. Here, look, let me show you. Here's Jeff right here. Pull this up. There he is. That's the man we know. Zach Allen. Amazing man. And I am so grateful that he touched my life in any, you know, just even for a short period of time. When he first came to Babylon 5, it was very exciting. I mean, come on, he was the cute guy from Taxi. We didn't have a cute guy on our show, so that was amazing and a great opportunity to have him be there with us. And I remember he was very excited about it and took it very serious, and he was super pro about everything, always on time, always had his lines down, always given latitude to play with it and make it more and really own it. It was just very exciting for us. It was very exciting for him, and I just remember those as being very, very happy days for him. I didn't know Jeff before the show, but I can say that look, I had already heard all the rumors that he had demons he was fighting, and that was to be understood. But, man, I sure didn't see any of that really while we were there, ever. And he would talk candidly about it. He was a man who had turned his life around, is really what was going on. And here he was, finally, the payoff for all the hard work that he had committed to himself was yielding this opportunity for him to be on a show again, which was really what he was all about. So it was really, really awesome for him. And he's just sparkled all the time. It was amazing. And we all know as B5 fans that he gave us just amazing performances as well. So it was really very, very cool and a happy time. And listen, Jeff also was a great friend, and threw amazing parties at his house. And I know I should say, you know, parties and abuse in the same sentence, but the parties weren't that way. They were just good. He threw a great Halloween party for us one year that was just so much fun. And I remember being at his house for other things where Jeff would play a lot of his music. He was into Christian music, and he was putting out this album, and he played a lot of that stuff for us. And he was riding a crest. He was having a great time. And obviously after B5 things, you know, his demons returned, and we all know the outcome there. That was kind of difficult. When B5 ended, as it does with all of the cast and crew, you know, life just goes on. You stay friends, but you don't stay in touch as much. And so just, you know, the years start to erode the amount of connectivity that you have to those people that you love so much and will always love. But Jeff and I actually did have a chance to reconnect under some really kind of weird circumstances. We did another show together, and that was Celebrity Rehab 2 with Dr. Drew. When Jeff was admitted to the hospital, as all the cast members typically are, they're admitted, and Dr. Drew immediately puts, you know, an awful lot of drugs in them to pretty much knock them out for a few days, so that they will start the detox process and clean themselves out so that they can begin their treatments. And so when Jeff arrived, he was pretty quickly swept away. I really didn't get a chance to see him. But he did. We had one moment a few days into it when he was being wheeled down the hall and I had come out of my office area. And the minute our eyes met, he sat up in that wheelchair. And you could just see the Zach Allen sparkle come back like that. I mean, he was just on it. It was very, very cool. And it was also great fortune that we had opportunity in the schedule that Jeff and I actually were able to go and sit underneath this big tree and just talk for an hour, catching up, talking about old friends, being, you know, just talking through life and just catching up is really what it was. It was just a very special one-hour period of time for me and for him. And I think it, once again, just bringing all those memories back into his head of how much fun we had on Babylon 5 really helped lift him up at a time when he was so, so far down. And as we know, you know, was able to go deeper. And you know, the thing that bothers me most about his passing is the business that I'm in is also the business responsible for his exploiting celebrities when they're having rough times. It's unusual because we don't ever make big public deals out of people who have problems in it, and so many, all of us do. And you know, if it's the guy next door or the guy down the street or a relative of yours or something like that, you know, the media doesn't get all over their case when they're having demons get the better of them. But boy, when you're a celebrity, we go right for the jugular right away. It's very unfortunate that all of us know as much as we know about Jeff, and we found out about it all through the wrong ways, you know. And anyway, I'll get off that. But here's what's important. I need you guys to know that I am very grateful that I had Jeff Conway in my life, even for a while. And I am truly honored that I can say that he's was a friend, and that I did care about him, and that I miss him, and I miss him very much, and we all will. And we are all super, super excited that he came to help us out as Zach Allen, because we really, really needed to have Zach, and he was good for us. So thank you, Jeff Conway. Thank you, Zach Allen. We'll miss you.
Wow, that's that is probably the most heartfelt thing I've heard out of any of the stuff that was written about Jeff's passing.
Yeah.
That's,
well, I think very little of it was written by people who knew him
or cared about him.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. So, Jeffrey, thank you so very much for sharing that with us. That was very heartfelt and emotional, and we appreciate it. All right, we should go take a break before I start weeping uncontrollably.
Yes.
Listen, I know how you feel. I've been there. You feel like you had a dream to write. Once. There were stories in your head that were unparalleled, and so much better than the stuff you bought in bookstores. You would be an author. You would show them all. But maybe along the way, you got discouraged. Maybe you bowed to the demands of life, family, career. Maybe you just thought you wouldn't be good enough, or that it was too late. But I'm here to tell you, you should be writing. At 5 years old, I Should Be Writing is one of the first writing podcasts. Author Mer Lafferty speaks to wannabe writers on the issues of keeping going from the beginning early stages of writing to keeping professional in the later stages of building a career. I speak weekly to professional authors about their work, their process, and advice that they have for you. There really is nothing stopping you. No, not that. Not that either. Nope. Whatever you're thinking of, it can't stop you. Trust me. Listen to I Should Be Writing at ishouldbewriting.com and learn more. Twice weekly and free, ishouldbewriting.com. Because you should be writing.
But I should be writing. I should be working on my craft.
Yeah, so how do you follow up with such a beautiful tribute to Jeff Conaway? Feedback-a-palooza.
Hearing feedback from everybody. We've actually got a lot stacked up, haven't we?
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. I just got a little carried away with the interviews, but hey, you deserve it. So if you have to a couple extra weeks for your feedback.
Yeah.
If anybody's
complaining about it, we're going to sick Margene Holden on your ass.
There you go.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie. Thinking about the resurgence of Day of the Dead discussion on the podcast, I was just thinking that on May 14th will be Neil Gaiman's Doctor Who episode. So I'll just be curious to see whether Tim has the same problem, similar problems with that as he had with Day of the Dead, or how it's gone about that.
Okay, the Neil Gaiman Doctor Who episode, The Doctor's Wife, was marvelous. I absolutely adored that episode. But Doctor Who is a different show than Babylon 5, and I think the kind of stories that Neil Gaiman writes, again, not that I've read everything the gentleman has written, But from what I've read, he works better in a universe like a Doctor Who than he does in a Babylon 5 universe.
I believe I read one comment from him that he had been working up to this for 30 years, meaning he's been a Doctor Who fan for a long time.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, it is as much a I don't want to say it's a fanboy thing, because it's not. But it is definitely a love letter from a fan to Doctor Who in a lot of ways. And it's really cool. I mean, it does some very nice things with that universe that makes you think, as every great episode should. It works well with what's gone before, makes you think differently about what there is, and, you know, points to some wonderful things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that as of the night we're recording this, which is June 15th, Neil is in the U.S. for his, I don't know, writing
for his Day of the Dead rubbing.
No. He spends a few months a year in his home in Wisconsin. And oh. I think he comes to the U.S. to get more writing done. So as not to be distracted by playing with his family and his dogs.
Okay.
But he's doing a tour of Southern California for the 10th anniversary of American Gods, which is just like, wait, that's 10 years old already? Holy cow.
Wow.
So now that he's in the States, I have reached out to see if he would, you know, join us for a few minutes, because he's a busy guy. He's got a lot of stuff to write.
Yeah, but we have talking to do.
I know.
Well, this is Neil from Bowie. Just finished listening to Show 230 and the discussion there about the sun casting and how long that discussion and the Day of the Dead discussions will be keeping on and on. And I think a good measure of time will be that those will go on at least until we've heard the full story of Crusade. Just exactly everything that was supposed to happen to those characters.
Yeah, you know, regarding stunt casting, I think with the last episode, Rules of the Game, that we deep geeked on, Lockley's character felt much more integrated into the concept of the show. And I, from what I've been able to read and what little we've got from the B5 Books people, it sounds like at some point, what was going to happen was B5 was going to be sort of a base of operations that the Excalibur would use as a port of call, and that's how they'd work the Lockley character in more often. So, so I think here it works better. In Ruling from the Tomb, it seemed kind of forced, and then of course.
And I'm going to say it was forced because it was at the conference on Mars, period. You know, having to wrap
right.
that around the having to wrap the conference around their, I guess, first real interaction, depending on which timeline you watch.
Yeah, it. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because the other.
Yeah. It just remember the episode where, the Rangers brought them the intel on the alien who had escaped with all the art and music.
Yes.
It just seemed like that would be
the, knees
the kind of,
Earth.
Yeah, like that would be the kind of meeting that would happen on Babylon 5, because Babylon 5 is such an integral part of the Rangers' mission at this point. Why not go where all the Rangers have to come and disperse again from anyway, instead of having them trek all the way out to where you are and then continue on their way. That just always made sense to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And of course then there's also Each Night I Dream of Home, where they just kind of pick up Lockley in the middle of space.
She was hitchhiking. They couldn't leave her out there.
No, well, I wouldn't leave her by the side of the road, I can tell you that.
Hey Babcast, this is Adam of Bureau 13. So, anyways, I'm making a comment on the episode, Patterns of the Soul. And there's a scene in there where Eilerson and Gideon are sitting side by side, pretty much, and they're both going over different reports. And Ireland stops. He turns to Captain Gideon and says, "You know, that's the difference between you and me, Captain. The corporation just tells me what to do, and I go do it. And you know what? If things happen that I didn't foresee, well, it's not my fault, because I just had to do what I was told." You know, that's always kind of bugged me, because if anybody should say that, it's Gideon. Because Gideon almost always has some bigwig back at the headquarters saying, "Look, you have to go do this now. You have to do this." While Ireland, once in a while, the corporation goes, "You haven't been sending us reports lately. Like, what's up with that?" And I don't know, perhaps it's just Jameis's way of having some of the person tell Captain Gideon, "Hey, you can just do it. You can just go ahead and kill those people or whatnot and have a good conscience because, hey, it's not your fault. You just do what you're told." But yeah, that just kind of bugged me in that, just for the reason that it was Ireland who said that and not Gideon. And yeah, have a good one. Bye.
Nope.
I was going to say the same thing.
Nope.
But you
nope,
go
nope.
First.
Okay. First of all, Ireland brings in huge chunks of cash for IPX, or brings in discoveries that generate huge chunks of cash for IPX. They're going to give him slack if he turns in reports once every 6 months, but also gives them an artifact that generates a billion credits for them. They'll give him some slack.
Well, they start giving him a little bit of grief, like in the long road.
He's not finding enough good stuff for them.
Right, right. Patterns of the Soul, where we've got the whole thing where Darina's people is found and blah 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 blah. And he elects not to share that information. The reason why I disagree with Adam is that I think, as much as anything, Eilerson says those things to poke people, because that's mm-hmm. that's what he does.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know? I can see that too.
He just, "I'm better than you because, you know, I don't have the problem of conscience. You know, I can just slough it off on the company." But I think that's posturing on his part. I don't think that's necessarily what, or I mean, especially what we see in Rules of the Game. I think that it's posturing because it's protection, because he actually does care. He just doesn't want anybody to know it. And Gideon, you know, he's all about breaking the rules anyways, but he's not, you know, again, with the events of Patterns of the Soul, in essence, he rigged the game so that Earth Force gets what they thought they wanted, you know, but he achieves a more humane end for that goal. So I don't see either of that as out of character. So,
hello, this is Neil from Bowie, listening to show 231. I just got to the point where him talking about Max Ireland leading his entry in Patterns from the Soul, and the glimmer of hope of a change in Max Ireland's character there, and that just points how much we really missed out with Crusade, that we didn't see all these characters grow for 5 seasons. See them go on their character arcs, whatever they may be. We got to experience so many changes for our Babylon 5 characters, and we are deprived of that in Crusade. Just another tragedy in this series.
Yep, totally agree.
I want more Crusade, damn it.
I think Margene does too.
Animated project.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie. I listened to show 233 of the David Allen Brooks interview, and that was just an amazing interview. Quite fascinating to hear what he had to say, and just too bad we can't get that history that he wrote up of Max Eilerson, because it's been interesting to know what he thought the history was, and I wonder if he ever showed that to JMS at any time, and I also wonder whether any of the other actors took it upon themselves to write some backstory to their characters. Anyway, great interview.
Thanks. Love the interview, too. And if you listened to last week's episode with Margene Holden, yes, apparently there was a bit of a backstory between Sarah Chambers and John Matheson that only now is coming to light.
From what I hear, a lot of actors will do that. They will develop backstories for their characters given after being given information by their directors or their producers or whatever, whoever's in charge of the story for whatever show or movie they're working on, and they'll just come up with stuff so that they have a better internal feel for the character. Whatever they come up with, 99.9% of the time, will never see the light of day by anybody. It's just right. For their own internal reference to know how a character would behave in a certain situation. Writers do it with coming up with character backgrounds for characters in their books that never see the light of day.
Now, if you pick up the B5 Books team's Crusade Other Voices Volume 2, that contains David Allan Brooks' write-up for Max's Back History, plus 3 poems written as Max Eilerson, and they're god awful poems, but they work because, you know, it seems like the kind of stuff a repressed prodigy who has no social ability would write. So it's cool that way.
Yeah.
Well, this is Nat from Bowie. I was in the show 236, and I've heard Adam's least favorite shows, and like you, I was quite surprised to see Mind War on his list. I guess he's, being from Bureau 13, he's just jealous of Bester there, but yeah, that was a very strong episode, and just quite surprised seeing that. I also support Summer's note with The Long Dark there with that nice little shadow tie-in. That's all.
Yeah, okay.
I wonder if we could come up with another poll, like an official poll on having people pick their 2 favorite episodes per season to give us 10 total or 10 total episodes. Because I have, like, for me, most of my favorite episodes happen in seasons 3 and 4.
Okay. I for me, it's kind of a mixed bag. There's a couple in season 2 that I like a lot, and mm-hmm. and I'm very fond of Soul Hunter and Midnight on the Firing Line. So, yeah, that might be fun to do. Sure.
Plan that out for later. Right now, everybody go keep voting on the Lita poll, because it's open again, and we're just having fun.
All right.
Hello, this is Neil from Bowie, listening to Show 236, and just heard Adam's discussion about Mimbar reaction and Summer's response there. And it was just thinking that I can't remember, maybe there's a hole in my mind or something, but I can't remember just whether we were told what the motivation of the Windsors was in The Gathering. I mean, there was that guy there who, with a change in that, who was working with Jakar, trying to assassinate Kosh and get Sinclair thrown off the station. And I'm not exactly sure whether we ever heard, you know, really what was behind it, whether it was, you know, somebody who did have inside knowledge about why they saved Sinclair and he wanted to try and sabotage that, or was angry at the Great Council because of the end of the war still, or what. Do you remember whether there was any concrete explanation? That's all.
You know, the short answer is no. I don't think we ever really got an explanation as to why everybody was doing what they were doing. When I reflect on the gathering, it really I ultimately come down to this, that it was a pilot for a series to sell the series to a network to say, look, it's got action and adventure and explodey spaceships and weird aliens and mysteries that we're only hinting at. Because other than that, I mean, there's a lot of, I don't want to say inconsistencies, but like the Vorlons don't behave like the Vorlons end up behaving throughout the series. You know, Jakar, you know, yeah, for most of the first season and into the second, he's sort of a conniving bastard. But even still, there's none of the, you know, he just seems really out to manipulate. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems it does seem in the pilot that the Vorlons were just on the same level as the other older races, like the Minbari and the Centauri. They weren't quite elevated to that mystical first ones status until we got to series.
Uh-huh.
And I think that affects some of the story that we got in the gathering.
Sure.
Because if you consider the Vorlons on the same level as the Centauri and the Minbari, it looks like a plot to take the Vorlon out in order for there to be more commerce for everybody else. More influence.
Yeah, right. I mean, mm-hmm. and then what that the wind swords, you know, to more to Neil's direct question, what would the wind swords be doing? Well, from what we understand through the rest of this series, it could be that there's a faction of wind swords who understand, if they don't necessarily know that Sinclair is Valen or, you know, has Minbari soul, that they're using, trying to take Sinclair out as a way to undermine the influence of the religious caste in the An Lashak. You know, I don't know. I mean, we could speculate on that, and that's fun. Don't get me wrong, but at the bottom line is, I think the gathering was just more to sell things, and not there's not in the series. The plot lines all tie up very well, or at least the loose threads don't feel like they don't make any sense. The gathering, the loose threads are all just they don't make any sense.
The gathering was a second draft.
Yeah, right.
Midnight on the firing line
was the final
polished. So there we go. Right.
Okay.
Well, this is Nelson Brewer listening to show 236 and discussion about the blowing up of Babylon 5 still disturbs me there, because they wanted to get rid of Babylon 5 because the use of it did not justify the operational cost to it. So I can understand that. That happens all the time. But the reason of getting rid of it once, nobody's controlling it because of danger to the shipping lanes just doesn't seem to ring true, as, of course, a million pieces of Babylon 5 would seem to be a much greater danger than just Babylon 5 up there.
Yeah.
There is one thing, though, that we might not have, counted on or thought about too much about that, and that, of course, is Drawl. Somehow, perhaps, maybe he had some planned and worked with them for getting rid of a million pieces of Babylon 5, and he, for some mystical reason, wanted to do that as opposed to just having Babylon 5 get somehow pushed into Epsilon 3 and just safely be disposed that way. But it's still, the whole thing is just doesn't make all that much sense. But that's the story that's there, and I guess we just have to live with it. That's all.
Well, Yeah, again, I mean, from where I come to that one, I am convinced that the destruction of Babylon 5 was a propaganda move on the part of those who wish to discredit Sheridan and the Interstellar Alliance. And it has no logic otherwise.
I see it both ways now. I actually have a different way of looking at it. Maybe Drawl didn't take it out because he didn't want people who didn't know he was already there to know he was there. Maybe certain people didn't want B5 there as a reminder. You know, maybe to undermine the Interstellar Alliance. I don't know. But I also look at it as we already know that the Earth Alliance in its structure is very Navy-like, right?
Okay, sure.
B5 is too big to have been converted into a museum.
Okay.
What does the Navy do with decommissioned ships? They strip them of everything that can be recycled, and then they usually destroy them by sinking them to help create new reefs. You can't really create a reef in space.
Well, and hyperspace.
Right. That's my other thing. Other than destroying Babylon 5, their only other option would have been to send it into hyperspace, throw it off the beacon, throw it off the network of beacons so that it wouldn't be a hazard. Just have it get lost in hyperspace someplace. But I don't think it. I think it would never have fit through the jump gates. That's the problem.
Well, I mean, no, we can argue that one because they moved the jump gate struts to pull the third space artifact through.
Right, but the third space artifact was nowhere near the size of B5 in terms of width or breadth. And
are you sure?
The farther you move the struts away from it, the more unstable the jump gate you create.
Yeah, okay.
So there's a limit to how big a gate you can create.
Sure. But to the point is that what we're told in the show is that Babylon 5 is destroyed because it is a, quote, hazard to navigation. All right? It's in a stable orbit around a planet. If it's a hazard to navigation and somebody's running into it, it's because they're not paying attention.
Right. All right? Every single memo you've got from a military press office has been 100% full of truth, right?
Well, and that's my point. That's my point is that it was destroyed as a propaganda measure or to send a message as opposed to really what they say it's about.
Okay.
That's the point I'm getting to, because you're right. Yes, what they tell you is wrong. That's not the truth, because as Neil points out, they blow it up and there's 100 godzillion pieces of it flying around through space. Oh, that's safer.
Well, you can have those little bots go around and collect those up easy. Come
yeah.
on.
No.
There you go.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Jason from Murfreesboro. I've been rewatching Crusade just like everybody else, and I wanted to get your thoughts on Racing the Night. You have to keep her that stays alive for 2 years while they try to find a cure. My thought is that, okay, this keeper dies after 2 years. Why don't they make the keeper stay out of cryostasis for 18 months? After 18 months, you bring somebody else out. He goes back to sleep. That way, he doesn't die, and that way you keep even more of your people alive. Granted, I know it's 2 years each time, but only 500 people have died so far. But it would seem like it might be a little bit better. I'll talk to you later. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we don't know enough about what cryostasis is in the Babylon 5 universe. It could be that when, you know, they do things like that, like when they put the wired telepaths in stasis and shipped them up to the Earth Force vessels in at the end of the Earth Civil War, maybe they felt that was a risk they can take. You know, we don't know whether or not a suspended animation carries any particular risks along with it. And they may not know what that might do with the Drock virus or to the Drock, any way you cut it. So
I was listening to you guys rant back and forth about you know, the telling of one story and there's two different views of it. Let's not forget that history is written by the winners, and it's always slanted, no matter how you look at it. And who other than somebody like a JMS would produce a story where the exact same event occurs and is witnessed by two people, yet sounds completely different when they recount it to someone? That is kind of a JMS thing. I mean, let's face it, this guy was really good at writing stories that made you talk about it. And let's not forget, this is how many years later, and you're still going back and forth about which way it looked. Yeah, I think that's part of the story, is that the story has multiple viewpoints and is viewed through different prisms of life and experience and reality and history too. The way the Centauri are going to tell a story is going to be very different than the way the Narn are going to tell a story. Centauri, you know, we were great. We ruled the universe with thousands of ships, and the Narn are, we've been, you know, subjugated the entire time, and on and on and on. So let's look at it from that point of view. Okay, gang? Talk to you later. Bye.
I think my most favorite moment that illustrates that actually comes from Lost Tales, when Sheridan is talking with Ventari, and they get on the subject of Veer, and Sheridan starts chuckling to himself and what a wonderful guy Veer is, and Ventari just looks at him and goes, "He murdered my father."
Yeah. There's always going to be different sides of the story that some people aren't going to have. What was it? You know, understanding is a three-edged sword. Well, mm-hmm. How many edges does the Sword of Truth have? Did I really just say
it has
that?
All of them?
It has all of them. Yeah, you're going to see, even two people witnessing the same incident, standing side by side, are going to see two different things. You know, ask any cop. Eyewitness testimony changes. It's different from person to person, even if five people standing 5 feet apart saw the same thing happen. Yeah, the movie Rashomon.
Yep, exactly.
Hi, this is Joe again. I figure everyone else leaves about 100 messages. I'll leave at least one or two more. So I want to get to what I'm going to say this, and Tim, you're going to be happy. I agree with you. There is no sense in making Babylon 5 darker. There's no sense. Why wouldn't we need 4 years of a Minbari civil war? We didn't even know who the Minbari were. Plus, we know how brutal the warrior caste is. It's called In the Beginning. There's nothing else you can say or do that, you know, the Minbari killing humans left and right. We know how brutal they are. So there's no need for that. There's no need to make Babylon 5 darker. It's kind of dark as it is. And you have the shadows. You have, you know, Psycor. You have, you know, an Earth government that is very corrupt, will do unspeakable things if crossed. There's no need to make it darker. And I disagree with if they had a network behind them. They did have a network behind them. Granted, it wasn't the greatest network, but they had a network that gave them 4 years, which is probably about 3 years longer than Fox would have given anyone, or any other channel, to be fair. So I just disagree with the idea that everything has to be darker, or, you know, if something else, what he would have changed. There's nothing else I don't think he'd ever change. Would he have done a little bit more lesbian stuff with Talia and Claudia? Maybe. So, just wanted to say that. Bye.
Now, we know where your agenda is.
Uh-huh. That's it. He didn't want a darker story. He wanted more sex like those TNT people did.
That's right. Yeah.
I will say this. My thirst for a darker story is currently being satiated because BBC America just started rerunning Battlestar Galactica.
Yep.
So I'll let you slide on this one.
Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and take a quick break, right?
Yes, we need a breather because I think we're coming up on a Gary Palooza.
Yeah, we've had the Neil Palooza, and we got the Gary Palooza.
So, you're still hanging on to that tiny thread of denial. Trying to convince yourself that sci-fi has nothing whatsoever to do with your life. Well, you better think again, Sparky. That tiny cell phone has no basis in Starfleet communicators. Those hands-free earpieces now used by virtually everybody didn't come down from the ear of Lieutenant Uhura. And that cute little Rumba vacuum cleaner that you use far too infrequently wasn't hijacked off an Imperial Star Cruiser. Nah, not a chance. Because if it were true, then you would be forced to turn on that Flash Gordon-inspired box on your desk called a computer and listen to sliceofsci-fi.com, the Bexim satellite radio show that will turn your sci-fi into reality.
And we are back with more Feedback-a-Palooza. Because you guys just can't stay off the phone. It's all good. That's what we like, though.
Yeah.
And thank you for your patience, because you see how long it takes for us to get to this stuff. All right, Mike. Next one.
Hey, Badcasters. It's Gary, and I was listening to Adam, one of our newer voicemail contributors. Yay, Adam. Keep calling. List his five worst episodes. And I noticed among these ones, one or two were a shocker, one or two I expected. He did not list TKO. Have we truly found the one fan that actually thinks this is a good episode? And if so, Adam, could you please expound on why you feel that that is less worse than your top, than your bottom five episodes? Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Well, wow. You know, just because it's not on the worst five doesn't mean it gets to the best five. TKO is pretty awful, but I've come around a bit on the Ivanova stuff.
I think that's the only thing anybody likes about that episode.
Maybe that was the problem. Maybe the only Babylon 5 episode anybody at TNT saw was TKO. And they said, dude, we'll put this show on right after wrestling.
Ooh. That's and not good.
And then they all took a swig of Zima and said, yeah.
Oh, Zima and cold meds, right?
Right.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Gary, and I'm listening to this whole debate about forgiveness, both online at the website in the comments field and online, and in the show itself here. And I never took it quite the way Summer's taking it. Honestly, the alien really had no power at all. But everyone has to forgive themselves, and I get the feeling that that's what this this alien allowed people to do. It allowed them perhaps a bit of reflection upon what had happened and helped them to realize that in so many different ways it wasn't their fault and that they needed to move on with their lives. So really, they forgave themselves. I don't think that it was really them accepting this third-party absolution, but rather them coming to terms with what had occurred and deciding to move forward, especially in the light of the Drock plague and with so much more serious things occurring, per se, itself right now, that they realized that some of these things had to be put aside and could be. So I'm sort of with a sense that, yes, I agree that the alien absolving these people is a bunch of hooey. But at the same time, I think it sort of presented their guilt to them in such a way that they were able to let it go. So that's my two cents. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Summer?
I am slightly reevaluating. Let's put it this way. I'm collecting more information. I'm not as abjectly opposed to it as I was before, but I'm not agreeing with it yet either. I'm still taking in more information because there's a lot more going on there.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, I have a very particular view about that. And I can see where some people might feel free to allow that to happen. I personally don't see it, but I could see situations where that might be.
Well, you know, the thing is that it is a very personal experience, and
yeah.
that's the key there.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Gary, and I'm still listening to you guys, Deep Geek on Ruling from the Tomb, and specifically the whole Trace Max Darina interaction. And I agree that it is weird, and it still does seem a touch out of character for Max, even with the hometown pride argument that he knows the best places to show her, or, you know, he wants to perhaps even impress in some way Darina. But one thing I have to keep in mind, especially reading other voices, is this is about the time they wanted to try and change Darina into the Captain Kirk of Crusade. They wanted to have her start sleeping around with aliens on every planet that they go to and make her a much more promiscuous woman than she has been shown to be. So I always took this little scene as, in a sense, them trying to, I don't know, I don't mean to insult anybody by saying make her more feminine or make her a bit more friendly to people in general, but that was the general point that I felt this was doing. It was sort of trying to feminize her a bit, and not necessarily in a good way, but to make her almost, you know, not quite helpless, but definitely start the whole sexual explorer routine that they were starting to throw to her character, or at least trying to in the memos. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
And you know what? I think there was a lack of imagination going on there in more ways than one.
Yeah.
Because, all right, first of all, Darina didn't need to become the
space hooch.
I'm gonna say companion. Firefly there. Gonna go Firefly and become a professional companion.
Okay. Yeah.
They missed the opportunity to give that role to Trace. Wouldn't that have been awesome? You got the low-level grunt, you know, who's just literally, he's waiting around to shuttle people back and forth, and he's like, hey, how are you doing? And he could be secretly gathering intel because nobody expects it from a low-level guy like him.
Right.
You know,
right.
Somebody who's part of the command staff, you're going to think they have an agenda. You know, this guy just piloting the shuttle, he's getting some on the side because he's bored. You know?
I have a feeling.
Perfect opportunity miss.
Yeah, I have a feeling Trace Miller would have been the Warren Keffer of Crusade, though.
And you know what? A year and a half later, they could have killed him off, but he would have been the sexual acrobatic exploiter that TNT was looking for.
He was pretty.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Gary, and oh, thank God I'm sane. I finally heard Summer admit that she does put in that WB music at the end. I swore I thought I was just hearing it in my head, and now it's nice to know that it is actually really there. Thank you for finally confirming that, Summer. Bye.
Gary, just because you hear the voices doesn't mean that you are not crazy. Wait.
And the thing is like I mix it up sometimes. Like I'll put one in there and it won't be in there for like 2 months, and then I'll put them like in like 2 and 3 weeks. It's hilarious.
They're so cute when you mess with them.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Gary, and I've chosen to embark upon yet another great Babylon 5 rewatch. I'm starting at midnight in the firing line, and I'm going to just keep going. Anyway, the reason that I'm calling is that as I start to watch the introductory Babylon 5, I did actually start off with The Gathering. And for the life of me, I cannot figure out what the heck it is that Dr. Kyle is supposed to be saying when he's got his surgical thing going on with Kosh. I mean, he's a being of energy. Even if he's given the illusion of having, like, guts and organs and stuff, unconscious, he's still doing this. I really want to go down to think that that Dr. Kyle's doing something with the encounter suit, and maybe it's, of course, we know it's probably biotech, given the Vorlon's penchant for living ships and stuff like that. So my guess is he's really fixing the suit itself and not really doing anything to Kosh. Because obviously that poison couldn't have done squat to Kosh himself, but maybe the encounter suit, I'm thinking. Just a thought, and I'll probably you guys into these things as I keep going through the watch. Maybe we didn't thoroughly flush out the first time.
Wait a minute. So does this mean that Gary's going to be sending us questions?
Yes, we're going to be hearing questions about Soul Hunter next. Absolutely.
Oh, jeez.
No doubt.
Oh, man.
Hey, you know, yes, this business with Kasha's encounter suit, I think, gets back to what we were talking earlier about The Gathering, that, you know, when you stop and look at it hard, there's a lot of it that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. What was Dr. Kyle messing around with?
I like to think that just because they are energy, that doesn't mean that they're not corporeal.
Okay.
I just remember the, because if he were pure energy, when he went unconscious, he would have dissipated into nothingness. That's not going to work.
Well, would he have? We don't know anything about Vorlon biology, really. Other than they get that weird squid thing
suit. So there has to, even though he's more energy than corporeal matter, there had to be something there. Otherwise, he would need a ship. He wouldn't, you know, he could just, you know, float through the bulkhead, no problem. You know, it's not like, honestly think that when Ironheart evolved, he went beyond where not even the Vorlons had gone yet. That's just my thing.
Right. Okay. I mean, I'll grant you some of that, but it was kind of, again, why are they going to try to poison Kosh except to maybe get them pissed off to blow up the station or whatever? But how would you know what kind of poison would affect a Vorlon?
Yeah, that is true.
You know,
that
doesn't quite hold up when you really stop to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, the Mimbari had been involved with the Vorlons the longest, but...
Oh, sure, but the Vorlons are going to go, oh, by the way, this is the most effective poison against our kind.
Well, no. I mean, the Windswords are sneaky. I mean, look what they did with
Deathwalker.
Can we get a sample of their DNA? Oh, they just, you know, sneak around, send a few people into deep space. So what if they get blown up, you know, before they get to the Vorlon homeworld? There's lots of places they could go to be, you know, sneaky. I don't know. Being apology girl now, aren't I?
Yeah, you are.
All right, next one.
Hey, Batcasters, it's Gary, and I have to say I really enjoyed Pat Tallman's interview. I don't know if she cursed quite as much as Claudia did when she did hers, but it was just hilarious, and I almost lost it a few times just listening to the conversation. You guys are still knocking it out of the park. I wasn't sure if you guys would be able to pull off a great season 5, given how we're reaching the end of material, at least televised material. But you guys keep knocking it out of the park. Keep up the great work, and I'll keep listening at least until Tim says David Dead's a good show. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Wow.
If that's all it takes for me to get out of this gig, oh, never mind then.
I think we're going to be waiting a long time.
Yeah, you're going to be waiting a long time. Although, No, I'll save it for later.
Okay.
I similar to your position with the forgiveness bit, I've been doing a lot of thinking about my position, and I could and if there were certain things different in that episode, I could accept the fact that they pulled a mile long section out of the station out of it, but we'll, you
know. I don't think it was a full mile, but yeah. So do we have any more voicemails?
I believe that is it.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for sending in your voicemails, and I'm sure we've got a whole lot more piled up since.
since our rerun with Margene and all the rest. Yeah.
Yeah. And we got some. We do have some really great other interviews coming up, and some more being planned. Working on it, folks. Yep. But as always, our website. BabylonPodcast.com. Come on by, leave some comments in, vote on your favorite Babylon Podcast episodes, vote in whatever polls may be running at the time, yeah. Whatever you see on the website, come on, chat with us all. Farpointforums.com.
Yeah, good comments there.
Yeah, Farpointforums.com. Our message boards are over there. And if you want to send in an email, say you have an anecdote about your memories of Babylon 5 or your memories of Babylon 5. When did you first start watching? That kind of stuff. Send those in to BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. And also, if you have a voicemail, you want to leave a comment on anything we've talked about here or some stuff we haven't gotten to yet, that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year Gary and Neil duked it out for supremacy.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the energy incorporeal beings.